It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. I first of all want to wish everyone a happy Memorial Day. When I wake up today, I was thinking, you know, it's Memorial Day. Today, even though people party, they celebrate, they get out with their friends and family, barbecues, people are drinking, having a great time. It's really a somber day in our history. You know, we live in the greatest country in the world, and Memorial Day is a day to reflect on the ultimate sacrifices the warriors have laid their lives down for us and the sacrifices of their families. These loved ones are gone, and basically, we never can forget the ultimate sacrifice. So God bless all those warriors, and may they rest in peace. Today, we have a wonderful show on the journey of giving back. You know, each week, I try to bring on folks making the world better, interesting, motivational, inspirational folks that are really people that I think we can learn from. And today, I have my great friend, Ed Capozzi on. You know, Ed is one of those guys in life I'm very lucky to know. He's quite a character, and we're going to explore his really interesting life. He's certified by the Supreme Court of New Jersey as a trial lawyer. He's a legendary trial lawyer here in New Jersey, and he goes throughout the entire country trying cases. He was the former president of the New Jersey Association for Justice. He's an author. He's a lecturer. And he actually started in life as a musician. And we're going to talk about his musical career and how he became a trial lawyer. We're going to talk about the work-life balance. How do you do it all? We're going to talk about youth sports. And most importantly, we're going to talk about the passion of living, living a very fulfilled life. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Todd.
So far, how'd you like that introduction?
That was pretty good.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. So, you know, Ed, on the journey of giving back, I really want to put the spotlight on people that have some interesting stories to tell, things we can learn from. And one of the things, as I was getting ready for the show, and I try to research people, and don't take it personally, I Googled you a little bit to learn more about your background. And I understood, you know, when I was starting to hear about who you are as a person, about your background, can you share a little bit about the influences your parents had in your life?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Long Island, in Oceanside, Long Island, which is kind of by Long Beach or, you know, Jones Beach in that area, South Shore of Long Island. And my father was an electrician, worked for the Long Island Lighting Company. My mother was a homemaker. I had two sisters and a brother, so I was the youngest. And I didn't really see my father that much because, you know, he worked for the Long Island Lighting Company for 46 years. And in those 46 years, he never called in sick once.
I read that, and I was like, oh, my God, not one day out? Never,
nope, not once.
Wow.
And he got an award for it. They gave him an ashtray, actually. I still have it. He passed away about 12 years ago. So the one thing I did get was this ashtray that the Long Island Lighting Company had given him. So it's kind of like the most sacred thing I have in my life. He also worked other jobs. He had a catering business. He bartended in a bowling alley. So, you know, we didn't really get to see him that much or talk to him that much. He was a very quiet guy, just all about work. And I guess that's where me and my brother, who's also a lawyer, we get our work ethic from because, you know, I don't know anybody who works as hard as the two of us. So definitely carried over the work ethic.
Yeah, you know, when I was thinking about Ed, your background, God rest your late dad, is your mom still with us?
Yes,
well,
yes.
God bless your mom. The influences parents have on kids' lives, and it's pretty remarkable how if you're blessed to have parents that really instill in you those values of working hard. My late father also was just cut from that same cloth. He worked his fanny off. He was one of those dads that, you know, he loved us, but he worked really hard. He was a trial lawyer. And as you know, being a trial lawyer, you are ultimately committed to your clients.
Yep.
And it's a balance. But, you know, God bless your late dad. And, you know, one of the things I also was reading is you started out, you worked your fanny off as a youngster. Tell us about your paperboy route when you were delivering papers.
So, you know, as a young kid, I didn't have any money. My father didn't really give us any money unless, you know, if I asked him for a quarter for the ice cream, man, he would get a little aggravated with me. So I knew I had to make my own money. So I had a paper route in the morning, the Daily News, and I'd have my bike and I'd have my, you know, the bag on the bike. I'd fill it with the papers in the morning in the rain and the snow. And I would deliver papers at 6 o'clock in the morning.
And now, you know, how old were you then?
Probably 8 or 9. And then I had a paper route after school, the Long Island Press. So after school, I would also do the papers. And, you know, then at night, you had to go collect the money from these people. And you'd knock on their door, collect, oh, I'll pay you next week. You know, and the paper was like 40 cents right. for the week, you know. So it was kind of funny when, you know, thinking back about it.
But you were pedaling on your bicycle in all kinds of weather conditions, right?
Yes. No,
so what's
man.
It like when you open the door and you're like, you know, you're 8 or 9 years old? I don't know. Yeah, I think you're on a Schwinn bike,
yeah.
And you got to load up all your papers, and it's snow, and you look out the door. What goes through your mind?
I don't even remember what was going through my mind, just that the papers had to be delivered.
You had to go then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's interesting, though. So, you know, that work ethic, I know you obviously miss your dad terribly, but the values he instilled in you to this very moment, I see you smile when you think about it, right? Because it made you who you are.
Absolutely. And, you know, not only that, I also had a job at a nursery. You know, this is maybe when I was 13, where we had, you know, during Christmas season, I would do the Christmas trees, you know, help people pick out trees and then wrap them up, put them on their cars. And we were working basically for tips. So made a few bucks doing that. Then I had to work at a pizzeria. Then I was helping out friends with construction. I was a tile setter for several years. I worked for the sanitation department as a garbage man for 2 years. While I was at college for the summers, I would come home and be a garbage man. But then I ended up not going back to college and staying on as just a full-time garbage man for a year, and then I ran back to school after that.
Yeah, what was that like, though? That I didn't realize. So you're in the sanitation business. Yeah. What is that like?
It's brutal.
Yeah. Like
in the summertime, it's 100 degrees, you know, and whatever I did, whether it was making pizza or, you know, delivering papers or as a sanitation worker, you know, I took a lot of pride in what I did. So I would run the route. I wouldn't even get on the truck, you know, unless I absolutely had to. But I would run the whole route, put the cans back on the curb, not throw them and let them roll in the street. I would put them back neatly. I just took a lot of pride in what I do. And me and my partner, we would try to, you know, do it as fast as we could. So we would try to, like, to break the record, how to get out of there as early as we can, but at the same time, doing a great job. So that was the dirtiest job I ever had. But, you know, like I said, I used it as a workout. And I took advantage of it. But, you know, doing jobs like that, they make, you know, they give you a lot of character because I don't forget where I came from. And now that I'm a lawyer, I'm glad I'm a lawyer, but, you know, I don't forget where I came from.
You know, going back to the folks that, you know, the sanitation workers, I know, first of all, they're really incredibly hard workers. I remember as a young kid, my parents would make sure whenever they were available and around, give them water. You know, and you would see the guys light up like they couldn't believe, because a lot of people don't appreciate the effort. You know, same thing with the folks clearing the streets in the wintertime. You know, these guys are working, you know, sometimes 36 hours at a time. And I know in the local town I'm in, if I can say to the guys, you want coffee, you want water, they're really appreciative. Just the thank you in life is important.
Yeah, well, we were the garbage men, you know, back, this is in the 80s. They would give us beer, you know, six-pack of beer. We'd put it on the side of the truck.
Not during the route, though, Ed, I hope.
Well, no, we wouldn't drink it on the route, but we would drink it later. But,
sure.
You know, one thing that I also remember is, you know, when you're doing the garbage, you're running in the middle of the street. Cars, they don't even care about you. They almost run you over 100 times a day.
Right.
You know, when I am driving down the street and I see the garbage man, I'm very, very observant. And, you know, I let them know I wait there as long as I have to wait, you know, because I've been there. You know, and they don't know that I was a garbage man, but I have done that job, so I know what it's like.
So, you know what's pretty crazy about life? So I saw you this morning. You stepped out of the car, something out of Central Casting, sartorially blessed, dressed. Look at you, handsome devil you are. But your humble beginnings, you know, that's humble. Because, like I said, you know, people in life, they start out in different paths, right? And you started out very humbly. You worked your fanny off. So when you, obviously, you had a different, diverse education in life. You know, one thing about being in school and learning, but you're out on the streets and you had a lot of different work. What do you think that's done for your life and career?
Well, as a lawyer, one of the things that I recognized, I was always a smart guy. I was, did well in school, but and I was among my friends, I was the smartest of the group, which wasn't hard to do. You know, they were really fun group of guys. But when I went to law school, for example, I realized, oh my God, all these people are really smart. But the one difference that I had, the one advantage I had, is I was street smart, and they weren't. I was a little older also. I was in my 30s. They were in their 20s. So I had lived life a little bit. So whenever we had to argue, like, against each other, I would literally destroy them, put them into the ground, because they just didn't have the experience that I had. So it gave me a big advantage.
Yeah, do you think you're better off now because of what you did, because you delayed your entry into the world of law?
Well, yeah, definitely, of course. I mean, sometimes I regret it because I think I wasted a lot of time, you know, playing music and doing other things. And then I say, and everybody always says, oh, yeah, that's what made you what you are now. You had to have done that to get to where you are.
So I know you love music. And one of the other things, like, you know, was just a really cool thing about you is you were a musician, like a rock star, a guitarist, a lead singer in the band The Poets, but I know you love Black Sabbath, and our engineer here, MK, she was all juice when I said, you know, Sabbath, she's like Ozzy, you know. So maybe we just get like a little riff. Little Iron Man. Thank you, MK. I'm not a big Black Sabbath fan, I'm sorry, but I mean, I did listen. I know we texted earlier this morning, you know, right into the void and Megalomania. Candidly, I never heard those before, but I respect it. Let's talk about music. So, you know, I understand you became really a well-known musician. You traveled the world. In fact, I read you played in front of like a million people in your career.
Maybe, yeah. Done a lot of shows.
So how'd you get involved in music?
Just like any kid got involved with music, I heard music. I heard Led Zeppelin, actually. It kind of changed my life. I heard a whole lot of love. I got in a car I was in eighth grade, and we got into a senior's car that was in high school, and he was playing A Whole Lot of Love. And I was like, what is this? And he was like, it's Led Zeppelin. So after that, I started listening to Led Zeppelin and, you know, the rock bands and things like that. And I had older brothers and sisters who had Beatle records and Pink Floyd and, you know, Blue Oyster Cult, all kinds of bands, you know. So I, you know, I would listen to their records. But, you know, then I started to try to, I taught myself how to play the guitar, and not very good at it. I never, you know, I became okay at it. But, you know, I joined a band when I was in, I believe, ninth grade, and the guitarist was great. He was doing like Eruption, all the Van Halen stuff. So I kind of played bass guitar with them. And then, you know, just I fell in love with it. We did a show one. This is what really kind of changed my life at that point. We did a show at the high school, Oceanside High School. It was a Friday night. And this is like, you know, life is so different now that they would never do this now. And there were 1,000 kids at the show. We played, and, you know, we had practiced for so long that we were actually pretty good. So we came out and played, and it was the first time I was on stage in front of people, and the euphoria that I felt.
Yeah, what'd that feel like?
I mean, it was like, you know, I wasn't on drugs, but it felt like what I imagined drugs would be like. It was just euphoric. So after that, I was hooked. And then I played probably the next 15, 18 years.
Were you nervous getting up on stage the first time?
First time, yeah. But again, I was a bass player, so it's more in the background. But eventually, I became a lead singer and a guitarist. But so one of the things that I, and this, again, it probably goes back to the work ethic. You know, we practice 7 days a week. To, you know, we would practice 7 days a week for 6 months to do one show, you know, back then, at least. And so we knew we were good because we were good because we practiced so much. As I got, you know, more and more involved in music, and that's really what it came down to. It's such a competitive business that if you're not practicing 7 days a week, the guys who make it are practicing 7 days a week. So you have to do it that way. It's like, you got to go all in. And that's kind of like my, you know, my motto for my life. I'm all in. When I do something, I go in all the way.
Why do you think that is? That because this is the title of the show is, you know, the passion, finding your passion. Why do you think, number one, you have that in you? Why do you think that's important?
Well, passion, if I could give one word about success, it'd be passion. If you're not passionate about something, you could forget it. Because, you know, there are people that are passionate. And if you're competing with these people, whether it be in business or in life, you're not going to win because they are motivated by passion. So that's something, I don't know if it's inbred in me or what, but I was always passionate about certain things. So whatever I did, whether it be even golfing, I got into golfing for a while. I would golf 5 days a week, you know.
What were you shooting back? Wait, what's going on? I didn't know you played golf.
Yeah, I did when I played music because I had the days off. Oh, so, you know, we play. It was shooting in the 80s, low 80s.
Nice.
But,
I haven't had a club in my trunk. That's where it's been.
Yeah, I haven't golfed. I golf if I'm lucky.
You
want to
know, though, we're members at a local club. I'm good on the 19th hole. I say to everyone, give me the green jacket at the 19th hole. But going back to, you know, the passion in music, how important was that to, you know, put your blood, sweat, and tears into the craft?
Well, like I said, if you're not going to do it that way, you're not going to be good. I mean, any band that has made it has played, you know, they always say, you know, like in The Outliers, 10,000 hours. Beatles put in 10,000 hours while they were in Germany. If you don't have the 10,000 hours, you're not going to be great. No, you're just not. I mean, yeah, there are people who can write a song and whatnot, but as far as performance and to be on, and another thing I learned about music is because, again, the, you know, musicians aren't the most reliable people. So I played with the same four guys for a long time, and they all had issues. So not only did I have to be good, they had to be good, and I had to drag them up the mountain on my back. I said, I'm dragging you guys up this mountain on my back because they would be late. They would be drunk. They would never. It's not just you. It's them. The one thing about being a lawyer, if I go to court, it's me. So if I'm good, I know I'm going to be good. I don't have to worry about the three guys that I have, you know, climbing on my back, carrying them up the mountain.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it's all part of teamwork if you're in a band. I mean, certainly the trial law, like you said, I mean, it's you, the other side, and the jury, and obviously your clients and the other side's, you know, clients as well. So you were in a band called The Poets, and I understand that you became a lead singer. Was that a hard thing to pivot to from being in the back? Now you're the front man.
Well, it was a transgression over many years. When I first started singing, we were doing things like Rush. You know, it was a three-piece band. We were doing things like Rush and Cream. And, you know, those are, at least Rush, a very hard group to sing. A lot of falsetto and things like that. So, I mean, I struggled. But then, I started taking singing lessons from an opera singer in New York and got better. I had my own style. Like, if you heard my music, you would know it's me because, you know.
I tried to find you, Dad. How do you find
really
it?
Hard to find. I mean, I don't know. I guess in the 90s, the early
90s. I mean,
yeah. There's one record you can find that I produced and played on called Beetlejuice, which was it was a New York tribute to the Beatles. It had C.J. Ramone on it. It had Stuttering John from Howard Stern. It had all New York bands. And it was received very highly. I started a label, Raven Records. And it was chosen by New York Post as the number 7 record of the year.
Wow.
And that was in 1995. So the record took off. I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to be a music producer. And I started to sign bands. And then, you know, got offered money to sell the label. My attorney at the time told me not to sell it. You know, you'll get more money next year, and I went out of business between then.
All right.
So, you know, I've learned a lot about life also from playing music because, you know, people would offer you small record deals, and, you know, we thought we were Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith. You know, we didn't have to sign this deal. We wanted the best deal. And then, you know, never got the big record deal. We got close a couple times. We never got the big deal. In hindsight, I would have taken all the small deals and worked my way up. You know, because if somebody's going to sign you, they'll buy out the small label.
So before we go further, that's interesting, too, for the listeners. And shout out on Facebook for those watching on Facebook as well. But in life, I mean, there's opportunities, and you have to know when to seize it. And like you said, sometimes you got to take the baby steps and ladder it up instead of, like, saying, I'm going to wait for the incredible dream situation.
Well, you know what? If people believe in you, it means a lot. So, you know, like I said, in hindsight, the people that actually believed in me first, you know, they should have been, number one, I should have taken those deals because, you know what, they were, just like I'm passionate about music, they were passionate about this band, and I could have done, I think, more had I done that instead of, like, held out for the big deal because ultimately the big deal never came.
Right.
So it's a tough business.
That's what I understand. I know it's like all businesses, it's real hard, but it also goes back to the passion, right? And you said some too, the folks that approach you, they did believe in you.
Yeah.
But I guess you just guys felt, hey, we could get a bigger, better deal. Isn't that part of the human condition too? The grass is always greener on the other side and you don't appreciate what you have?
Yeah, I think I listened to a lot of people and I shouldn't have listened to the people that I listened to in hindsight. Now, maybe they had my best interest in mind. I think more they had their best interest in mind. But in hindsight, it's all,
So you've listened to yourself, you think, Ed?
Yeah, and I listen to myself a lot more now,
Right.
So, a lot of people, especially lawyers, everybody has an opinion. And sometimes, they break you down by wearing you down by, in the back of my mind, I'm like, no, I don't believe in that. I shouldn't do that, but sometimes you have no choice because it's not just you. There's a lot of other people involved.
Right. Right. Also part of life's mysteries, too. And I always like to say I studied the human condition. I'm trying to still learn about myself, which is always a mystery. I'm a bit mysterious to what I think. No, but the reality is that, sometimes you have to make some bad decisions so that when another situation comes up, you have the experience. Because everybody who thinks they're going to be in the ivory tower, it's going to be peaches and cream in life, all your decisions are going to be perfect. That's not the real world anyone's living in, right?
No.
You name anybody that's been successful. They made bad decisions, but they learned and they keep on going.
I think Thomas Edison said that, you got to have 1,000 failures to have 1 success. I've heard Teddy Roosevelt also say things like that. There's quotes of his saying, you got to err, you got to fail, and get back up on the horse and just keep going. And, you learn a lot. I mean, a lot of lawyers say you learn more from your losses at trial than you do your wins.
Right. Don't make me feel sad right now. I'm taking a few right on the chin. I got a few hit from behind, too. I don't know. I thought I had eyes behind me, but I didn't. So, from a musician, and you were obviously successful, what made you decide, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
It was more the lifestyle. The lifestyle was a very tough lifestyle. We played at night, and we played 250 shows a year. So, we're pretty much playing every other night or, 3 or 4 or 5 nights in a row, in different cities and things. It was a tough lifestyle. Winters, I didn't even see the light of day. We'd, see the sun come up, but I wouldn't, by the time I woke up, the sun was down already. I don't know. It was an ugly lifestyle. So I'm, my brother's a lawyer and he talked me into going to law school, this was in 2000. So that's when I started.
So before we get into your incredible law career, I'm just curious. Your beautiful wife and you're blessed with the beautiful kids. You have 4 kids. But is it as crazy as, you see on TV and the movies about some of these bands, Motley Crue? It looks like beyond bananas.
It's crazier.
Real life
will show you half the things.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, we can move on. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But I just wonder, I know there's a lot of drugs. And, obviously, some people make some horrible choices and they end up ruining their lives and unfortunately, people around them. So your brother, you obviously probably respected him. I mean, and he's telling you about the legal career. What were you thinking? I mean, why law?
It just seemed like what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be an American history teacher. That's what's really what my goal was. I love American history. And when I started to look for jobs as a teacher, the salaries were so low. I mean, I couldn't survive on it. I mean, I had student loans now. So I decided to go to law school instead. And I went to law school and I wasn't looking to become rich or anything like that or become a great trial lawyer. I didn't even know any of these things that were possible. I just wanted security. I hadn't gotten a paycheck in a long time, because when you play music, you don't get a paycheck. You get some cash, here and there. So, that's what I want. I wanted security. I just wanted my life to be stable instead of unstable. So that was what my goal was. And little did I know that, wow, this stuff is actually, if you work really hard and then, I thought being a lawyer was going to court. I didn't know 97% of lawyers don't go to court. I thought that was all it was. And that's the only thing I ever wanted to do. If I'm going to do this, this is what I'm going to do. And then I started to do it and started to win some cases. And I didn't realize how hard it was to win these cases because to me, I was just, winging it kind of. So became pretty well known just for being able to win some of these trials. These soft tissue auto cases and things like that in New Jersey. And a lot of opportunities opened up for me and just because of that. And just kept doing it. You know, I mean, the thing I miss most is, you know, after this pandemic was the, you know, I used to be in court 40 weeks a year. Now I'm in court 3 weeks a year if I'm lucky. I mean, can't get to a judge, can't get to a jury, you can't get to court. Because, you know, they're so backed up because they closed down for 2.5 years that it's very frustrating, you know. So, you know, somebody who was going to court trying 16, 17 cases a year for 10 years straight, and then all of a sudden, you know, don't go to court for 3 years. It's kind of,
No question about it. Hey, look, I mean, obviously I'm in the same industry, and I can relate to what you said. When you pass the bar and you're going to try your first case. Now, you're already in your 30s, right, at that point.
Uh-huh.
And the firm you're with, I think you're in a Philadelphia firm, they put you out there. Now, how did you feel? Did you feel that you could do it? Did you feel like, you know, were you nervous? How did you feel?
Well, the Philadelphia firm was, so I worked for a firm in Philadelphia that they are what made me a good lawyer. I mean, I learned from some of the best lawyers. They didn't let me do anything. What they did was they let me prepare with, you know, help them prepare for their trials, taught me how to be a lawyer, taught me how to, you know, do the research. Because I would, they'd ask me a question. I'd say, I think, and they'd say, I don't want to know what you think. I want to know what you know. What is the, you know, the answer to this question? So, and I would see them not do that with other lawyers and the, you know, associates at the firm. So one day I said to my boss, I said, well, how come when I answer a question, I think you scream at me? And when they, he said, you don't say anything. He goes, because you're going to be a superstar, and I want you to be the best. You know, so he yelled at me because he thought I had some talent.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, it is important to find a job and mentors in life and to find the right work environment, too. And I hear the way you're discussing how formative it is in your life as a person, as a lawyer. When your boss in a prominent Philadelphia firm was giving you that, even though we're giving you maybe tough love, how'd you feel though when they were basically instilling in you that confidence that you had that gift?
I didn't know that's what they were doing to me, because I was pretty upset about it, because I would see how I was being treated differently than everybody else. But when he finally explained that to me, it made me feel a lot better. And, you know, it took pride. Like I said, then it made me work harder. And ultimately, I came to New Jersey. My son was in New Jersey at the time, and I wanted to see him play sports. He was a senior in high school at the time. My oldest son, Alex, is now my partner at my firm, which
That's
is pretty
great,
cool.
Yeah. Really cool.
So I moved to New Jersey to see him play his senior year of sports, because I had basically missed it all because I was down in Philly. I was in law school. So and I got a job with a small firm in Fort Lee, and they're the ones that gave me the opportunity to try cases. And then luckily, I won a lot of them. And they just said, you know, you're trying every case from now on.
Yeah, so for the listeners, Ed's being extraordinarily modest. I mean, you're one of the guys that came on the scene in personal injury, only because that's what I do, you know, during the week. And I love doing my show, but, you know, like this Ed Capozzi's coming on, and you're trying case after case, and you're winning them, and there are big numbers coming in for your clients, and your reputation was growing. And I was also like, who is this Ed Capozzi guy? I mean, I never heard of the guy. And you're like, you know, kicking butt and taking names. Where did you find the courage just to get up and do something different from, you know, your background being an entertainer? I want to explore that.
Well, I didn't know this at the time. I was actually how it kind of the light bulb went off. I was reading this Johnny Cochran book, and he said the best lawyer he ever knew was a prosecutor in the L.A. prosecutor's office who was a musician. And he said he had a rapport with the jury that you couldn't, you know, replicate. So I said, that makes sense. Here I am doing all these shows. I was a front man for a band, did about 2,500 shows. And now all of a sudden I'm in a courtroom and I'm basically putting on a show for the jury. So that's the first time the light bulb went off. Ah, there is actually some correlation between being a musician and being a lawyer, because ultimately you are putting on a show. When I was a musician, especially towards the, you know, middle to the end of my musical career, I knew we were good because, you know, we were good. you know, and we practiced a lot, so I knew we were good. When I first became a lawyer, I didn't know I was good. I didn't have a lot of confidence. You know, I was scared to death. But ultimately started to win, gives you confidence. And then, you know, what I do with the jury is I just talk to them as if they're my friends. I tell them a story, whereas I felt the, you know, defense lawyers were kind of a little arrogant and condescending towards the jury. So I tried to basically just talk to them like I was talking to my friends and the people that were injured. You know, I was trying to help them, and it wasn't their fault. The defense attorneys would blame the person bringing the lawsuit as if it's their fault that you're in court here, when I ultimately it's the other person's fault. If the guy wasn't on his phone, not paying attention, or speeding, or driving like a jerk, we wouldn't be here. So they want to make my client look like a liar, and it's all their fault. But in reality, it's the other person's fault.
Yeah, no doubt.
So you
got to
flip it on them. You got to put it back on them.
So we're going to take a short break and be back in 30 seconds with legendary trial lawyer Ed Capozzi.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
Welcome back. We're with my great friend, Edward Capozzi. So, Ed, you know, we were talking about trial work, and, you know, obviously it takes a certain type of person to stand up and talk to jurors because your clients are relying on you, and it is a battle. And it's something you got to put your heart and soul into it. When you are on trial, how intense is your life in terms of what you need to do, not only to get ready, but the actual trial itself? Because obviously, you know, I read in your book, which is a wonderful book, The Domino Theory. Ed's authored actually two books, so we're going to talk about it. But, you know, the trial is like a battle. It's war. So what's it like in your life?
It's all, I mean, it is brutal. I mean, you know, the preparation that goes into a trial, I mean, you're working on these cases sometimes 3, 4, 7 years, you know, you've been working on them. So, you know, I don't prepare as much for a trial because I know the case because I've worked on it for 7 years or 4 years or whatever it is. But, you know, you have to, depending on what's going to happen every day, the first couple of days you're going to pick a jury. So that's not too much preparation, but you're, you know, you're away from your family. You know, we research the jurors. So we kind of know who they are. We try to figure out who would be the best jurors for our case. But then once the trial starts, you know, you're literally working 20 hours a day. And a lot of times in my cases, there's a lot of money on the table. But I want the number to be the right number for my clients, not for the insurance company. So, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm preparing for a witness I'm going to call the next day. And I'm saying to myself, I could settle this case. Like, I could go to bed right now, wake up, go to court, settle this case, and it'll be over. But no. Why, you know, I yell at myself, like, why didn't you do it? Why do you do this to yourself, you know? But because it is a very, very hard case, you know, hard life when you're on trial. You know, you don't sleep for 5, 6, 8, 12, however many days this trial goes. That's why when you see these long trials on TV, 9 months or a year, like O.J. Simpson trial, I mean, those poor lawyers. I mean, they haven't slept in a year. You know, I mean, it's really taxing on your body. But because I used to try so many cases and win them, I mean, I went 6 years once without losing a trial, and I would be trying 15 a year. Those trials, because you win, it rejuvenates you, and then you build your stamina when you go from one trial to the next trial to the next trial. That's what worries me about now, coming back after all this time off. Like, am I going to have the stamina? Now, I'm going to have to build up that stamina again, you know.
It's probably like a surgeon. If you're not in the operating room and then you got to go back into the courtroom and, you know, the stakes are the case. I mean, if you don't win it, the client, unfortunately, is not being compensated for the horrific losses. It's a lot of pressure. How do you handle the pressure, Ed? I mean, because obviously in the business, you know, the personal injury world, or any law, or any profession, people are counting on you to deliver, but especially in the personal injury world, because people are seriously injured, sadly, loved ones are lost. The pressure, how do you handle the pressure?
I just handle it. I mean, you know, just like anybody, I think every, you know, baseball players or any athlete or anybody that has any pressure on them, you know, you just basically, you definitely have butterflies, you're nervous. But once the bell rings, once it starts, kind of that stuff goes to the background. I don't even think about it anymore. But, you know, I put a lot of pressure on myself also. Like, I'll talk to an adjuster and tell them you're getting fired after this case if you don't give me that money. You know, like, then I'm saying to myself, why did I do that? I could have just, you know, tried the case. But, you know, I do put a lot of added pressure on myself. But I think I perform
I like
under pressure.
I might try that sometime.
It works.
I'm afraid it's going to backfire on me, too.
Well, I've been lucky. It's never backfired on me because I always say to myself, why did I do that? Now I have even more pressure on myself.
You like to get all in. You're like all in. So that's like your passion. So tell us about the passion you have when you're on trial for your client's cause. How important is that when you have to present a case?
Well, number one, I believe in my cases and I believe in my clients. So when I'm talking to a jury, it's all coming out of my heart and my soul. And I know the jury knows I'm not like, you know, faking it or, you know, not being sincere. So it's coming out of my soul. I leave it all out there. I mean, by the time I close, when I'm done with my closing argument, I sit back in my chair. I'm like a jello. I mean, I just melt away because there's nothing left of me. I've left it all out on that courtroom floor. I think that's the only way you can do it. You have to do it that way.
What about in life too, then, when you're doing something? What are your thoughts about just for everyone listening, because not everyone's lawyers. Obviously, many people are doing different things in life. What about the effort they should put into their work?
I think you should have passion no matter what you do. Like I said, when I was a garbage man or I was a tile setter, I would try to do it perfectly. I mean, look at some of the architecture and things that you see from the past. Those people obviously took passion and pride in what they did. I think a lot of people today don't. They just go through the motions. Something that bothers me, if I go to a fast food restaurant or if I go to a drive-through, sometimes the people are so nice. And it's like they hand me the thing, we have a little conversation. I would literally drive away smiling. Other times, they throw it at you, basically. You can tell they just don't want to be there. And I feel like saying to them, I don't, because I don't want to get into a fight at the drive-thru. Why don't you quit this job and get another job? I mean, because you suck at this job. You know, you're miserable. So I think, yeah, you know, you got to be happy in life. Life's too short. You spend a lot of time at your work. A lot of time. So if you're going to, the luckiest thing that ever happened to me was finding the law. Because I love the law. I love what I do. So I always say, I haven't worked a day in my life. I drive to work 5 o'clock in the morning or whatever time it is. I got a smile from ear to ear.
Yeah, you work your family.
I like it. So
you do, yeah. You're blessed to have that. And for the listeners, if they want to reach out to you, how do they reach you?
Well, my firm, I'm a member at a firm called Brock Eichler in Roseland. We have, and I have a website, which is called njlawresults.com. My number at my office is 973-364-8300. You can Google me. You'll find me that way.
Wonderful.
It's a lot of ways to find me.
You know, I also know that you have an email address with the number 15 for the late, great Thurman Munson. And, you know, that's just interesting, just a little digression, because I used to follow sports, loved it, and I don't know, I'm blessed with kids, and the other things happen in my life. I'm not as engaged in it. Why is Thurman Munson such an important figure to you?
Well, I played baseball as a kid, and I'm from New York. And it's not only Thurman Munson. It's Thurman Munson was the catcher for the Yankees. He was number 15. Jerry Grody was the catcher for the Mets. He was number 15. So I started out as a Mets fan because my father was a Mets fan. And he would take us to Mets game. He never take us to the Yankee games. He said he wasn't going to take us to the Bronx.
Yeah.
But so we went to Queens. And I was a catcher. So number 15 was just always my favorite number because of those two guys. So that's how I, you know, my email address, ecaposi15.
Right, yeah.
Came from those two catchers.
Unbelievable. That's important. And, you know, in your book, Domino Theory, and Ed's actually authored two books, which are really wonderful books, not just about for lawyers, but about life. Yeah, you really wrote a remarkable book. And in fact, I was telling Ed in my office, we look at this because there's like, it's chock full of like great nuggets of great useful information. And you share a lot about, you know, a technique. And, you know, one of the things too in life, which is important, is to try to get back and share your knowledge, because you have all this knowledge and you don't share it. No one will know about it. Why did you decide to write these books?
Well, the domino theory and how it just came about was I was on trial, and I had probably tried 40 or 50 cases at the time. And the jury kept requesting the judge to reread the proximate cause charge, which is one of the jury charges in a case, on the negligence cases. And I, you know, had every time they would ask it, and this is in every trial, 40 trials in a row. So by like the 30th or 35th trial, I started to spend a lot of time on it, and still they would always ask the question. So I was standing in the hallway, I was reading the jury charge, which was like 2 pages long, and so convoluted, it's like legalese. And I saw a line that said, a cause that sets in motion a sequence of events. So I, right away, I thought of dominoes. So the next trial, I had created these dominoes that had the facts of the case on it, and I wanted to show how the negligence set in motion and knocked over all the dominoes. So I did it, and the jury came back in like 20 minutes with a verdict. I thought I lost, and I actually won. And they didn't ask to reread the proximate cause charge. So I started to do this in every case and get verdicts in 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, like very quickly. Whereas usually as a plaintiff, if you're, it's going to take at least an hour, two or three to get a verdict, because people, they have to discuss money. They have to answer all of these questions. So if you get a verdict very quickly, it's usually you lost. So I was getting these verdicts very quickly, you know, and I was winning. So I took that whole question out of the jury's mind, and I just made it very simple for them. And lawyers started to come to my house, calling me on Sunday, can I borrow your dominoes? I have a trial next week. And I'm like, well, I have a trial next week. Like, make sure you bring them back. And they wouldn't bring them back. I'd have to hunt them down.
You like the paperboy route you had, something
yeah. like that. Yeah, it was... You know, and then I started to do seminars teaching people how to use the dominoes. And I was doing this in California. I was doing it in a lot of different places. And then the trial guides approached me, which is a publishing company, wanted to write the book. So I wrote the book. And then by the time I finished writing that book, I had another book ready to go, because it takes so long to edit a book that it's very frustrating. I had to rewrite that book, the first book, probably 25 times.
Wow, that's a lot of rewrites.
It's a constant. Add this. You know, like I said, by the time that book actually came out, my dominoes in court had evolved into a whole nother animal.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, it's really an important compendium for lawyers, but in life, too. In your book, in the first one, there's a lot of cites to, like, famous folks in history. And it's kind of interesting how you weave in those quotes.
Yeah.
And why did you do that?
I don't know. I think I saw it in another book. Like, you know, when you read a book, the beginning of the chapter has a little quote. So I kind of like that, you know, because I like to read the quotes. But some of them I just thought were really good. I mean, there's the one about the agony, you know, the one of the chapters that's towards the end is about losing a trial. Like, I had just lost a trial when I was writing like the last chapter of the book. And, you know, you've had the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. And there's a great Kennedy quote in there about, you know, every victor has 1,000 fathers, but every loss is an orphan, you know?
Right, exactly. So I want to just ask you this, because you've gone throughout our great country trying cases. And there's a time where you do your closing. First the defendant normally goes, then you go and you do your closing. What do you do in that time period? From the time you guys do your closing to the time you hear there's a verdict? Because, I mean, what's that feeling like? Can you tell us?
Well, I've had juries deliberate 5 days. I've had juries deliberate 2 days, 50 times. I mean, a lot of my trials, the jury deliberates for a long time. And that's probably the worst part of the trial. I don't handle that well.
Yeah, what do you do?
You know, you can't, you know, you see on TV, everybody goes to lunch and they leave. You know, we don't leave because the jury could have a question. You know, you're not trying the OJ case or one of these big cases where it's on television. So as the judge, you can't just leave the courthouse. You got to be around. Because mostly because not that the jury's going to have a verdict, the jury might have a question. So you can't just leave them waiting for 2 hours till the lawyers get gathered up again. You got to kind of give them the answer now. So I just, you know, I'll either sit in the hallway, I'll go outside, you know, I'm around, but I mean, I'm nervous as hell. But the one thing you can say is, well, it's too late now. You know, because you're going through your mind what I did. I'm like, oh, I could have done this. I should have done that. I could have done this. But then at the end of the day, like, you'll win the trial and say, oh, I guess that didn't matter. So the more of these that you do, you get a little more used to it. But it's still probably my least favorite part of the trial.
Yeah. You know, I used to try a case with my late dad and my brother. Scott's a great local lawyer, too. And we always used to joke, like, lightning in a bottle. You don't really want to open the bottle. But there are some emotions that are, like, so incredibly raw in that process. Sometimes you might pray. Sometimes, you know, you just close your eyes. And then, like you said, though, it's all done no matter what happens. But it's pretty interesting, you know, about what we do.
I do like, though, to talk to my clients during that time because I want them to know. Like, I want to know what their opinion is of what happened during that trial. And they're usually really positive. Oh, you know, you beat him. You beat his rear end, you know, whatnot. Because if you end up losing the case, you know, then they could say, oh, you didn't do a good job. You know, I always want
to. From a hero to a bum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, luckily, like I said, I haven't lost that many times, but it does. If I lose, I'm ready to jump off the George Washington Bridge. I mean, it really affects me. You know, it eats at me. It's one of the worst feelings in the world.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it'll shake you to your core and question your ability. What do you think is the biggest misconceptions for the public about personal injury trial lawyers? Because they're always the butt of jokes, but they're the first ones people will call when there's a calamity. What do you think is the biggest misconception?
Well, because, you know, you see all these billboards on the highway with, you know, things like, you know, with about money and about cash. And I mean, people that haven't been injured or have somebody doesn't know somebody who's been injured, you know, and there's a lot of people that luckily have never been injured or their families never been injured. You know, I can understand why they would feel that way. However, if you're a personal injury lawyer, you file complaints, you do depositions, you do, you know, motions, arbitrations, you know, mediations, trials. I mean, you are a full lawyer. You are a real lawyer. You do all of the things that lawyers should be doing. So for that reason, I think it's really a great profession. But I think there's the misconception, I think it is, because, you know, we pick juries and the jurors say, oh, they're all full of, you know, they're all frauds and they're, you know, because they haven't been there. Unfortunately, and then the most important thing is you have insurance companies that have a lot of money that, you know, spend a ton of money on advertising and a ton of money on propaganda and things like that. So that's, you know, they have more money than we have. So they spend more money and their message is probably, you know, clearer than ours. You know, look at the McDonald's coffee case. You know, there's a documentary on it called Cup of Coffee or whatever it's called. And because I hear it 100 times every time I pick a jury, oh, this is all plaintiffs are frauds, you know, the McDonald's coffee case. And I have to bite my tongue, but I'm always saying to them, did you know what happened in that case? Like, before you start talking about it, you haven't really heard what happened. You're just seeing in the newspaper them beating up this poor woman because she filed this lawsuit. But in reality, it was a horrific case. So, you know, you should really watch that documentary, Cup of Coffee, because it tells you all about that case and all the facts of that case. And it's not a lady who spilled a cup of coffee on herself. She had 9 surgeries following this cup of coffee spilling on her. There were 700 complaints prior to her spilling that coffee. I mean, there's a lot of really, you know, facts that would change, I think, everybody's mind on that case. So.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, Ed. I also understand your all-time favorite lawyer was Melvin Belli, the late Melvin Belli. And I also read that he was a wild man outside the courtroom. And, you know, obviously at times in your life, you also live life to the fullest. Even when you're done doing your work as a trial lawyer, you enjoy life. Why do you think that's important?
You got to balance your life. I mean, this is a very, very stressful job. And I think if you don't release your tension or your, at some point, you could die. So, you know, I try to have as much fun, you know, not, you know, partying fun, but fun with my family. I do things with my family. I don't miss any of their games or practices. Like, I make it work, you know, somehow.
Yeah. You know, Ed, this is one of the things that is really remarkable because I know you personally. And I know one of your sons is a tremendous goalie, and he's so involved going throughout not just United States, and the Eastern, you know, seaboard, but Canada, there's a tournament in Austria. How the heck do you do that? How do you, I mean, you're blessed with, you have four kids, and you have so many responsibilities with your professional life. How do you do that? Because that's striking to me.
It's difficult to do. I mean, you just make it work. I mean, luckily, like I said, the last 3 years have been kind of easier to do it because there haven't been as many trials and as many court appearances and things like that, which is, you know, primarily what I do. So I have a lot more time on my hands than I would have had, say, 3 years ago. But even then, I made it work. I mean, there have been times where, you know, luckily the hockey community is, you know, a bunch of close-knit people. So, and some, you know, we don't all live in the same area, but there's always somebody nearby. So if they have to go to Boston or Chicago or, you know, Cleveland or, you know, Pittsburgh, wherever we have to go, I could, somebody could drive them there and I could meet them. I'll fly out, you know, if I have a trial and we have to leave on Thursday morning, I have to be in court Thursday, Friday, I'll fly out Friday night, meet them there. So they'll stay with him. He'll stay with them for a day or so. But luckily I've been able to make, you know, 99% of these tournaments.
That's pretty incredible, Ed. And obviously you have another son that's a budding hockey star. You have a daughter, a gymnast. Your other son, Alex, who is also a partner now at Brett Geikler, which is a prestigious law firm. What's it like, you know, having your son, Alex, part of your team there? What's that like as a dad?
Oh, he makes me very proud. I mean, he just got a verdict a couple weeks ago that was, you know, pretty tough case. And I think he's tried 10 cases, won all 10, which is, you know, a pretty good start because it is hard. It's hard to win these cases.
It is hard to win.
They're not easy. So he's off to a really good start. I couldn't be more proud of him. He's such a good, you know, a good kid. But you know what? He's passionate, too. I mean, here's a guy, you know, I go to the office, and it was recently, this was about 2 weeks ago. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I had to go pick up something. His car was there. He was the only car in the whole parking lot because he was working on it.
What is it like when you pulled into the parking lot in Roseland? And you saw your son's car. That what do you think?
I just smiled because I know that's what you have to do if you're going to be successful and you're on trial. You got to do the work. I like to do that kind of. I like to go to the office too. You know, I'm much more productive in the office at night, not during the day, because a million people are asking you questions. Hard to work during the day. So if I'm on trial, I'll work from home during the day, but at night I'll go to the office because then it's easier to work from the office because I don't have my kids bothering me.
So do you sleep at all, lad? I mean, how do you find the time?
I do sleep. I like to stay up late, though, because, you know, you get home from work, say it's 7 o'clock, 8, whatever time it is, you get home from work. If, you know, you're tired. So most people I know, they'll eat dinner, they'll go to bed. I'm like, I eat dinner, and then I stay up because if I go to sleep, then I'm going to work again the next morning. I want to enjoy my life a little bit. So I'll stay up and I'll watch, you know, a football game, a hockey game, a baseball game, whatever. Or I'll watch, you know, Forensic Files or one of these, you know, investigative courtroom type shows.
You know what's interesting? People bash lawyers. But they love the shows.
Yeah, I know.
It's kind of interesting, right? Oh, I can't stand the lawyers. But you watch some of the greatest hits, yeah, our lawyer-related shows. Your wife is also, you know, an incredible lady. How important is your wife in your life? You know, hopefully, you know, Maya's listening to this. How important is she in your life in terms of being able to do what you do?
Well, I always say this. You know, I had a nice trajectory going when I, you know, first moved to New Jersey. And then I met her and got married. Like, knew I was going to marry her. I got married very quickly, within like 6 or 8 months, had started having children with her. And my career just took off like a rocket ship. I mean, I was focused. I had a reason, you know, to work, I guess.
Yeah. So, well, my wife hopefully is listening too. Just had her 10-year anniversary to my wife, Jane. And similarly, we're blessed with some kids, and I've been very fortunate. You know, things have worked out very nicely for us as well. But I'm very blessed and humbled by the ability to help, you know, our clients. You know, youth sports are really important. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, one of your sons, like you said, is a tremendous hockey player. Does he play other sports? Is it kind of just hockey?
No, he played baseball. I played baseball, so, you know, naturally he would be playing baseball because when he was 1 year old, I was throwing balls at him, you know, so he actually got pretty good at baseball. And then he started playing hockey when he was about 5 or 6. So then he was playing both sports, and then he started to play football, but it interfered with hockey. So And then what happened was last year or 2 years ago, and this is very common in youth sports, all of the baseball players switched to play lacrosse. Because I think, you know, me, somebody who loved baseball growing up, and to this day, not as much as I used to, only because the game, I was bored with the game. And I know kids were bored with the game.
Wait, why do you think they're bored?
Because the game is a slow-moving game. It's not a lot of action. You know, the action is going on between the pitcher and the catcher and the batter. And then if the ball gets hit, then whoever gets the ball. A lot of guys are standing around for a lot of time.
I know a lot of dads win T-ball. They're all like, oh, my God. Even the watcher, like, oh, my God. This is taking a long time.
I know, and especially when they start really pitching the kids, they walk a lot of kids. So there's a lot.
I was a hard, you know, I played some baseball. I was never tall. I've been accused of a lot of things. I was hard to strike out. Because the batter's zone was like, you know, seriously, it's like a thimble. And then I would crouch down. I was a menace. And I was quick on the bases. Yeah. I was like a pest. All right, sorry, carry on.
So he switched from baseball to lacrosse, so he plays lacrosse now. He's not a goalie in lacrosse. He plays out, so he likes to score goals, so it's a different thing for him, but he loves lacrosse. And like I said, a lot of the kids that he played baseball with all now play lacrosse. So it looks like baseball, you know, is kind of like a dying breed, unfortunately, because it's still a great sport. But hockey, he plays hockey all year round, so hockey's always come first. So if we have a tournament in Boston or Austria, wherever we're going, then he misses whatever lacrosse is there, you know, scheduled during that time. And we come back, he goes back to lacrosse.
Now your son's 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're in Austria for a tournament. The only reason why I know, I saw it on Facebook, because I'm like a bit of a socialite. I got to stay on top of what's going on in the world. I'm like, how the heck is Ed Kaposi in Austria? And then I'll send you a message. I'm like, you're like an incredible dad. So are you nervous when, like, you're at these games? Because, you know, this is intense youth hockey.
I'm more nervous at those games than I am at the biggest trial of my life because it's out of my control, you know. Goalie's a really tough position. You know, you have to be really mentally strong for it. So, like I said, when you're a father watching, anytime the puck crosses the blue line, I start having heart palpitations because, you know, it's very nerve-wracking for me. He seems to be fine with it, you know. So
tell me, like, with your involvement with your kids and the work-life balance, because that's also what we're discussing right now with you, Ed, is because I do think it's vitally important. No matter what you do in life, if you're just one-dimensional, work, 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 you may have a huge bank account. But at what expense? What's the cost if that's all you're doing? You recognize, though, the importance of that balance. How does your family react? Because as they're getting older, I'm sure they're starting to realize, wait a minute, like, you know, daddy's actually, he's there.
Well, I can only be at one place at one time. So I have three kids that are young. So they're all involved in sports. You know, I spend most of the time with my older son because he travels the most. My younger son, you know, I take him to hockey when I can, baseball, but his mother's, you know, is taking my daughter, my wife is taking my daughter and my youngest son most of the time because I gotta work and I gotta take him to wherever he's going. Nothing is close. Everything is, you know, Boston, Pittsburgh, Toronto, you know, Chicago, it's tennis, Nashville, you know, we'll go have Philadelphia. I mean, Philadelphia is a close trip. I like Philly, you know, but Pittsburgh, Chicago, Indiana, I mean, wherever we go, it's far usually. So it's several, Detroit, several days.
That's just an incredible thing that you're able to do. Because I think of my late dad, and he was just an incredible person, and my mom was wonderful. And my dad was the only dad that would show up. And it was rare because my dad worked his fanny off at 744 Broad Street in Newark at the Humphrey Spear Building. But he would go to baseball and he would have a three-piece suit to watch for. And he would be throwing, like, you know, baseball practice and all the other dads who are like in jeans and a tank top or T-shirt. But I appreciated it. And even to this day, my dad's been gone since 2009 in January. And I still think about, like, how important that was in my life. And that's why it's a beautiful thing you're able to do that, Ed. Before we end this incredibly, you know, really powerful show, anything you want to share with the listeners about the passion and about doing something you really enjoy in life?
Well, like I said earlier, because, you know, your job, for example, because you spend so much time there, you really got to like it. Because a lot of people, I think it's probably the the majority of people, you know, they go to their jobs and they watch the clock and they just want to get out of there, you know, and that's pretty common. So, but I think you got to find something in life, something that you're passionate about, and that, and try to, you know, make that work as your life, as your job. Like I said, I stumbled across what I do now, kind of. That's the one blessing I have. But if you're not passionate about anything, I mean, I think it's really hard to be successful. You have to be yourself. You know, when I first became a lawyer, I knew some great lawyers, and I was like, oh man, that person's so eloquent. He's so great. I would try to copy that person. You can't copy somebody else. You have to be yourself. Because when you're yourself, what you say to a jury or anybody, a client, comes out sincere because it's coming from you. You're not trying to be somebody else. So that, to me, be yourself, be passionate. Those are probably the two most important things.
Well, I'd just say God bless you, because you're an incredible person, a great friend of mine. I'm so blessed that you're someone that, you know, I know well. I admire what you do. Keep it up. You're a remarkable person. And for the listeners, remember, find your passion in life. Nothing's more important than making yourself happy. And if you're happy, your family will be happy and the world will be better. God bless you. And please tune in next Sunday. Take care.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.